Hi, this is Alan Shartok. Joining us today are Susan Kane and Andrew Ellsbury, a Hudson Valley horse owner and breeder licensed in New York since 1984. Kane is the creator and host of the television series Unbridled and author of the upcoming book Bandit Story, an account of 6 months in the life of an average racehorse. Kane's husband, Andrew Ellsbury, is a certified journeyman farrier, and to put it mildly, he's been the head of the whole farriers organization for the whole country. Andrew is licensed to put shoes on racehorses at the New York Racing Association run tracks. Susan Kane and Andrew Ellsbury, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us, Alan.
Alan, thank you so much. It's really a privilege to be here, and I appreciate the time to speak up for horses on WAMC.
Great, and I want you guys to feel free at any moment when I'm talking to one, to the other one, to just say, I have something to say here too. Okay. So Susan, why don't we start with you? You're so passionate about all of this. What's the problem?
Oh, Alan, it's just absolutely enormous. The horse industry is huge in New York State. It contributes $4.2 billion to the New York State economy and is number two in agriculture statewide. And I have been a lifelong horsewoman, horse lover. I have dreamed of this day to come in racing. And when I say this day, a day when purses are increased and the breeding fund is finally rocking and rolling. And because of what I have experienced over the last few years, I have actually divested myself of my entire racing and breeding stable. The industry is as corrupt as it is large. And I say that, and that is evidenced by the behavior of the New York Racing Association, the recent closures of New York City OTB, and quite frankly, the dereliction of duty of the New York Racing and Wagering Board in their failure to oversee veterinarian activities at Belmont Aqueduct in Saratoga. And our governor uncovered that. It was revealed in a task force report that he ordered regarding the increase in breakdowns at Aqueduct Racetrack.
What do you mean breakdowns?
Horses that broke their legs racing at Aqueduct. It was twice the number of previous years, and 21 horses lost their lives, and the report revealed that had NYRA and Racing and Wagering Board done their jobs, that possibly 11 of those horses would still be alive. I personally could no longer stomach what I was seeing and experiencing, and that's why I chose to get out of the industry and now advocate and spend my time and energy in an effort to clean up racing and make life better for racehorses in New York.
So is racing something that we should stop? In other words, are we exploiting the horses by racing them, or is it just a matter of taking advantage of them and not treating them well?
Well, Alan, I see no reason for racing to continue to exist in the manner that it's run today. It is exploiting horses, and it is exploiting people. And I'll give you an example of that, which will come out in Bandit's story. Bandit was a racehorse that I owned in New York, and he was extensively treated with drugs without my permission or consent. Bandit eventually broke down. Fortunately, he did live. I was able to save him. He broke his knee. But when animals are exploited and trainers are trying to get an edge in an effort to win, they're giving horses drugs that are masking pain and allow horses to run that should not be running. They're not only hurting the horse, but they're endangering the life of the jockey that is on that animal. And I see no reason for state funds or extra revenues from VLTs.
Define VLT for our listeners.
VLTs are video lottery terminals that are in place at Aqueduct Racetrack, and they came into existence about a year and a half ago. And as a result of VLTs, purse money in New York has increased by 40%, which is $40 million. Mm. So a lot of horses are coming to New York. They're trying to win. They're trying to win that money specifically. And in doing so, they are exploiting animals and endangering the lives of jockeys. Veterinarians and trainers have literally run amok without oversight. And that did come out in the task force report as a factor that contributed to the breakdown of the horses. So I see no reason for $40 million to go to animal abuse and endangering the lives of jockeys when this state is in need of so many other things that could help it.
So I want to take you guys back, if I may, to something you said earlier, which I'm sure our listeners are interested in, and that is that your horse, Bandit, was mistreated by whom? And you assert that you didn't know anything about it, but you were the owner. How did that happen?
That came about, Alan, through Dr. Hunt and Bruce Levine. Dr. Hunt is the veterinarian involved in Bandit's case, and Bruce Levine is the trainer. In constant communication with the trainer, weekly reports, the trainer would tell me the horse was sound, there's no problems, there's no issues. I personally knew the horse because I galloped the horse, I breezed the horse, I prepped him to go to the racetrack, so I knew him to be a sound, suitable racehorse. What Mr. Levine did not tell me was that Dr. Hunt was treating this horse with an extensive bevy of drugs, primarily clenbuterol, which is the only FDA-approved bronchodilator. It goes under the trade name Ventipulmin on the racetrack. However, it was created to help horses with airway inflammatory disease. Its primary use on the racetrack is for its anabolic steroid effect, and it has become dispensed in mass on racetracks throughout this country and has become very problematic. It's very controversial in California, for example, has banned its use more than any other racetracks. New York just now, and thanks to the governor's task force report findings, has passed a law that clenbuterol cannot be used within 21 days of a race. So in Bandit's case, he received close to 2,000 cc's of clenbuterol in a 3.5 month period.
And you know this how?
I know this because subsequently the veterinarian finally sent me bills, and all of these dispensements were on the bills that I received. When I questioned the veterinarian, he said that it was done at the behest of the trainer.
Could you just stop there for
sure.
a moment, and maybe you guys could explain to me, you and Andrew, your husband, what the relationship between an owner and a trainer is.
Sure. An owner and a trainer is a relationship that varies greatly depending on the owner themselves and the trainer. The trainer is the primary caregiver and person responsible for a racehorse at the track. I, as an owner, insist on communication from my trainers, and I also insist that any veterinary procedures be discussed with me prior to being administered or a bill, billable work being done on a horse.
So that wasn't done in this case?
It was not done in this case.
And just because I'm always wary of legal issues, you have proof of that?
I do have proof of that. And I have to tell you, Bandit was on the cover of the New York Times with me, and the interrogation and fact-finding I went through with the Times was frightening. They triple-checked every single jot and tittle of every bill, every communication, every legal issue.
Has this gotten into a legal procedure at all?
It has gotten into a legal procedure. The veterinarian is suing me for his bill that I refused to pay. And the reason I refused to pay it is that I, as an owner, I do not feel obligated to pay any service provider that shows depraved indifference toward an animal or toward a human. And with the excessive dispensing and administration of clenbuterol, they were far above therapeutic levels, and they were at levels that science indicates causes structural changes in a horse's heart and predisposes that horse to aortic rupture. If a jockey is on the horse at that time, that's a very deadly combination.
Andrew, where do you come into this whole story?
Well, just to add a little bit to what Susan had to say there, a trainer's responsibility is to get the horse fit and ready to race. A trainer's responsibility also should include doing things that are conscionable in the best interests of the horse. In the racehorse business, you get paid to win. The horse that finishes 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, so on and so forth, doesn't get a check. Nothing. So the trainer has to balance the need to win with the health of the horse. Different owners are going to look at it different ways. I may own a horse and say, do whatever you have to do, whatever drugs. Look at the Lance Armstrong situation. Now we look at that and everybody's calling Lance Armstrong a cheater, yet they couldn't find anybody to award his medals to.
Because everybody else was doing it too.
They said the next person that down the line that legitimately would win the Tour de France was riding a stationary bike in his basement.
That's funny, sort of like me.
But yet, owners have a conscience. Susan, as an owner, would not want her horse on any of those drugs. Typically, in the industry, vet bills tend to lag 60 to 90 days behind. Mm. By the time the vet does it, and it gets in. So an owner finds out 60 days later that, yeah, the horse was out, breezing well, jogging every single day, but yet was on a painkiller to do that. Intra-articular injections, which are injections of steroids into the joints of a horse, have become way commonplace on New York State racetracks. The use of clenbuterol to build muscle and mass on horses, you'd be hard-pressed to find a horse that isn't getting it. Lasix, 20 years ago, I worked on a New Jersey track, and Lasix, which is a diuretic, causes a horse to lose body weight prior to a race. It was an embarrassment if you had a horse. It was administered because the horse ruptured capillaries in its respiratory system and did what they called bleed, basically a bloody nose. So by administering the diuretic, this would be less prevalent. Now, you're hard-pressed to find a horse in New York State that's not administered Lasix prior to a race. Why? Because nobody wants to give that 10% body weight up in a race. They want that horse as light as he could possibly
be. Why is that? Out of my naive understanding of horse racing, why is it better that the horse is light?
Less mass to move down the track.
I see.
The less weight you're carrying, the faster you can go. Now imagine a marathon runner going out. I mean, as human beings, we'd do everything to hydrate our body before we'd go and exert it. With horses, they're doing everything to get the water out of them.
Let me ask you both, Susan and Andrew, would we be better off not giving any of these drugs to any horse?
In my opinion, yes. It would level the playing field. It would encourage trainers to get back to real horsemanship and actually condition horses. It would probably avert horses going to the track that should not be there in the first place. Economics drive the industry. When an individual breeds a horse and it's 2 or 3 years after that horse has been bred and they have, you know, about $100,000 invested in it, they want to get that horse to the racetrack to get a shot at purse money. That is their only hope of financially regaining any funds they've invested in that horse. And that's part of a much larger problem with the entire industry is that it's simply not a sustainable business model. Horses are not an investment, and they really don't make sense to put your money in to make money.
Well, what do people do it? What did you do it? What other people do it?
I got involved with it as part of my life. I've always had horses, and I thought, well, New York is here. I have some horse sense. There's a good incentive program. I can breed a few horses to race, hopefully inure breeders' awards from them, and I can do it on a budget because I'm doing a lot of the work myself. I would not have been able to do it if I was an individual without a horse farm and I had to pay and outsource every single aspect of that horse's
life. So you
life
have a horse
to
farm.
Get it to the races. I no longer have a horse farm. I did have a horse farm for actually all of my life. I've had horse farms.
You know, they say there is nothing worse than a smoker who's given up smoking. And so I'm wondering whether or not, you know, to some degree, after all of these years of having horses, you know, your turn has been, you know, 180 degrees. Where does this come from? Does it come from guilt? Does it come from what?
No, it's really, you know, it's time for me to move on, Alan. It started about 10 years ago. At that time, I had both riding horses, show horses, and some race horses. And I decided at that point, I really wanted to move out of the hands-on farming end of it. It is an excruciating amount of work.
Like what?
What do you have to do? 24/7. In my case, I did everything from mucking stalls, feeding horses, riding, training, teaching, scheduled the blacksmith, worked with the veterinarian, scheduled the shipping to horse shows or horse races. So it's really 24/7 when you're engaged as a hands-on participant in the horse industry. And at that point, I felt I had accumulated enough knowledge and wisdom and know-how, and I really wanted to share through media all of the different aspects of the horse world, and that they were in fact available and accessible to everybody, because I felt like horses were perceived as somebody was betting their last 5 cents at the rail, or you had to be, you know, a blue blood Forbes 400 heir in order to participate. And
well, where did you fit? I'm sorry, Susan. I'm sure everybody's just screaming at me to ask you this question. Where did you fit in that you had such a farm and you had all these horses? You obviously had to have a lot of money.
Well, I was very blessed that I had a father who was a successful businessman. He had left the farm to myself and my mom. So I grew up on a horse farm.
What business is he in?
He was a manufacturer of men's outerwear. He had large factory in Troy. He had 1,500 people employed in Troy. And he was an avid horse lover, but simply pleasure horses.
Yeah.
And the same with my mother. She always had some pleasure horses. And I literally just fell in love with horses.
And where's your farm?
That farm was located in Troy. It was out in Brunswick. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful piece of property. And it's still a horse farm under different ownership. And in subsequent years, I've had a farm in the Hudson Valley, which we hadn't just closed up. So I fit in by way of my family, you know, and being involved, and I just fell in love with horses as a young girl.
Okay. Andrew, where'd you meet Susan?
I met Susan as her farrier.
How did that go? I mean, how did you set eyes on each other and you just sort of decided?
And she chased me. we met and we had a professional relationship for several years where I worked on her horses, and we shared a lot of things in common as far as keeping horses sound and a more holistic approach to the shoeing of horses and the maintenance of the horse.
How'd you get into the horse shoeing business?
I grew up in a town called Greenville, New York, and actually lived about a mile from two farriers and worked with them all the time when I was 13, 14, 15 years old. And when I graduated high school, decided that it was a trade that I'd like to pursue. I went to Texas and went to school.
Wait, where'd you go to school? Is there a farrier school?
There's several farrier schools. Matter of fact, Cornell University has one of the best farrier schools in the country. I went to the North Texas Institute of Horseshoeing, which was a farrier school that had been in existence for about 20 years. I went in 1977.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of us who are listening right now are interested in, God, you know, you have to put that shoe on the horse and then you have to nail it in. And I've often wondered, boy, that must be painful.
It's not painful at all to the horse.
If
it's done correctly. And if you do it for a little while, it doesn't get painful for the farrier either. The farrier business in the United States is interesting. And as we talked about the drug use in the racehorses, England and Europe seem to be miles and miles ahead of us on these questions. For instance, most drugs are not allowed to be used at all in England. Lasix that we talked about before, they don't race horses on it. And they come here to the Breeders' Cup and literally kick our butts every year because it's more done on a holistic basis. And the training is far superior to the training that's done here in this country without the use of drugs. Farriers in England are required 2 years academic training, 2 years apprenticeship, and then go and take a test. So you have to have 4 years of documented experience in the industry before you're allowed to take the test. In the United States, you can go to Tractor Supply or any other hardware store, buy a box of nails and four horseshoes and be a horseshoer. And this is, I worked for 10 years. I was a member of the American Farriers Association for probably 25 years. I worked for 10 years as an examiner of their certification program, which is, by the way, all volunteer.
And what is an examiner of the certification program?
The American Farriers Association looked for a way to accreditate people as farriers. It's like here anybody could be a carpenter. So at what level is this carpenter? Is he a master finisher, finishing carpenter, or is he a framing carpenter? So the American Farriers Association drew up three different tests of minimum standards. This would be a basic farrier, a certified journeyman farrier would be the highest, and in the middle was a tradesman farrier. We wrote a guidelines and description booklet, which tells the candidates for this exactly how the job has to be done. Not every day, but for the test that you're going to take. Basically a rule book and a description. At the time that I was an examiner, there were, I think, 18 examiners across the country. And people that have worked in the industries for years and years and years and realize the need for some sort of standardization and some sort of recognition.
So, okay, so as an examiner, I come to you and I say, examine me, you know, what do I do? What are you looking for? I mean, what would be a bad thing that they did that would make them fail a test?
Well, anything that would endanger the horse would automatically
give
be
an example.
A finish. Cut the foot too short.
What does that mean?
It means cut the foot down to a point where the horse can no longer soundly walk on it.
I mean, cut the foot down. I mean, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well you're going to have to go get in the truck and go to work with me, Alan. Okay. A horse's foot, and the entire reason for proper hoof care, a horse's foot grows at a rate of about a quarter inch every 4 weeks. A horse has an optimal point where that foot is long enough that he's sound on it, and he can work efficiently with it. If it's too long, he's no longer efficient. It'd be like you walking in a pair of clown shoes.
Yeah, but most of us who are listening to you right now, and it is fascinating, realize that our feet don't grow, you know, quite as fast, and we don't cut them down. But horses do. This is something I've just learned.
Well, like your toenails.
Yeah.
Or your fingernails. As they grow, you trim them. As a horse's foot grows, when that foot becomes 3/8 of an inch longer than where he efficiently works at it, it's now more work for that horse to do the same job. And in the same way, if the horse is working on hard, dry ground, he could wear and erode away more foot.
So the farrier can actually take some of the foot off.
We actually do.
Yeah. And that's not a vet's job, that's a farrier's job.
That's a farrier's job.
Yeah. Now, I think everybody wants me to ask you this, which is, you said before you can nail this thing into the foot, but if it's done right, the horse won't feel it. Why not?
The construction of the hoof, if you start from the inside of the hoof out, inside you have the coffin bone, which is a bone exactly shaped like the foot. That is surrounded in a capsule of not muscle, but meat, flesh, and blood vessels that supply blood to the bone. Then next you have what is called the lamina, and it's a cartilage-like structure that interdigitates with another piece of lamina, which is then connected to the hoof wall, which is what we see on the outside. The hoof wall itself is keratin, a material that's like our fingernails and our hair, and it has no feeling. So as long as the nails go up through the, starting in the lamina and out through the hoof wall, the horse doesn't feel it a bit.
Why do we ever get into shoeing horses? Historically, I mean, why not just let them run on their bare feet?
The history of horses is the history of civilization.
Right.
I mean, wars were fought. The first horse was shod somewhere about 2000 before Christ. Why? Because of man wanting to make war on people further away than he could walk. He needed to drag his implements of war to faraway places. And a horse by himself couldn't do that without the aid of protection for his feet and without the maintenance.
And what were those early shoes? Also metal?
All metal. Some incidences of hides stretched to stop the erosion. But as soon as they learned to work metal and nail it on, it was metal. The Chinese, there was a Chinese exhibit, and I think part of it I saw at the horse park in Kentucky. The Chinese were the first ones that understood using a breast collar around a horse, and it increased. Now a horse could work for 8, 10, 12 hours a day. The first people that tried to move loads with horses basically wrapped a noose around the horse's neck and had him drag it. The horse struggled to move whatever the load was for 3 or 4 minutes and was done. So it's the technology of horses that helped the advancement of civilization.
Now, as science has gone further, has the material that you use, for example, you always hear that the space program has created, you know, new materials, titaniums and things that we didn't have before. Is that true in horseshoeing also?
You know, in the horse business, we have a saying, if you're not cheating, you're not trying hard enough. So in several different aspects it has. Certain horses, like the Tennessee walking horses, the idea there is to improve the gait. The more weight you can add, the more you improve the gait.
Interesting.
So certain metals weigh more than other metals. So I can make a shoe out of a very heavy metal that looks like it weighs 16 ounces and it weighs 3 pounds. So the Tennessee walking horse, people have to be on the lookout from that. In good ways, there's glues and composite materials now where if a horse damages a hoof to a point where it's so short that he would not be sound on it, it's now possible for a farrier or a veterinarian to come in there and repair that until such point that it grows out and the horse remains useful. And part of our job is to keep the horse useful. People are paying massive bills every month, whether it be a racehorse or a show horse, to have that horse and use it. So the more you can do to keep that horse usable, the happier the customer is. Happy customer means more business for all of us.
So if the horse's foot goes too short, it's much like we see, and you're going out running on a train and you see somebody with a walking shoe that has been constructed by a vet. Is that sort of the same thing or not?
Proper maintenance would keep it from happening.
Yeah, but once it happens.
When it happens, like I often go to a client and they say, my horse just isn't acting right. You know, he's been not eager and willing to go to work every day, or I tried to trail ride him and he doesn't want to do what I'm asking him. He doesn't have a happy attitude towards his work. And I'll invariably take a look at his feet and see that the hoof capsule is eroded down to the point where it's not comfortable for the horse to work. So we put a set of horseshoes on the horse, and you hear from the customer 2 days later, my God, he's back to his own self, and very happy to go to work.
Our guests are Susan Kane, a licensed horse breeder and owner and the host of Unbridled, and her husband, farrier Andrew Elsbury. Susan, let's go back to you for a little while now. Andrew is fascinating. I must admit I can't get enough of a world I know nothing about. Tell us a little bit about Naira.
Oh, Naira has had a long standing.
It's the New York Racing Association.
Yes, New York Racing Association. They have had a lot of battles, a lot of corruptions, and a lot of bad behavior over the years. And
how so? What did they do that was so corrupt?
Well, I mean, part of what they did was they have a long history of taking money from different aspects of their finances that belonged to the horsemen and to go into purses that wound up going elsewhere. Nobody seems to know. Most recently, about $8 million was kept in Naira accounts that was supposed to go to bettors that were betting on races. And, you know, to really add insult to injury, most recently, Charles Hayward, the president who has stepped down, he was having a $250,000 mural painted of himself. Well, horses were dropping dead, you know, left and right around the racetrack. So it just seemed to be an organization that was focused on their own comforts and their own six-figure salaries, while letting horse racing just crumble around them, whether it be policing, you know, what is going on the backstretch, or the protocols by which horses are entered or scratched from races. And all of this finally came to the surface with a series of articles that the New York Times put forth on death and disarray at America's racetracks. They started to pull back the veil that, you know, this organization was more concerned about themselves than the health, welfare, and safety of horses that are racing at Naira tracks.
Now, Susan, correct me if I'm wrong, the people who were at Naira obviously reported to people who were appointed by politicians, right? So should there be dark music playing in the background in terms of public corruption here?
Oh, gosh, I think so. I think it marches to that tune. There's a lot of special interest money at stake. New York State Racing and Wagering Board did not do its job in overseeing the reporting of intra-articular injections in horses, which were attributed to horses breaking down in high numbers at Aqueduct, because that is a procedure, again, that masks pain in horses. So a veterinarian that looks at a horse before it starts in a race could not even tell if that horse had an injury or was lame, and therefore it did not scratch the horse. So it just became one error on top of the next that has compounded, whether it be political, economic, legal structures, lack of policing, lack of oversight. Case in point, in my particular situation with the veterinarian. Veterinarians in New York State are licensed through the Department of Education. Legally, veterinarians are held to the same standard of malpractice as human doctors. They are required to keep and maintain treatment records that are to be available at an owner's request at any time. And in my experience with Bandit, upon requesting treatment records and starting to invoke what was legally available to me as an owner in the state of New York, nothing was forthcoming. I simply got letters from the veterinarians that say, well, this is the way that we do things. I went to the Department of Education with my billing records, letters from the vet, recordings of conversations, and said, you know, you license this veterinarian. These are all of the violations. Please take some sort of action. I am advised by the Department of Education an investigation is open on it. But again, this is stuff that Naira and New York State Racing and Wagering Board, if they just did their job, you know, every day and oversaw that there was integrity and above board care of the horses, I wouldn't be in this situation, and a number of other owners wouldn't be either.
Well, what I don't get is, if you appoint people to be an oversight board, they obviously have to have some qualifications, and they obviously have to be in a position to do what you expect them to do. But if politicians start you know, getting involved in this. Sometimes people show up who shouldn't be there. Did everybody on the NIRA board and the executives have the kind of training that would have allowed them to do what you've just said?
In my opinion, as a horseman, as a hands-on horseman, no. These are business people running a franchise for the state of New York. They're interested in the bottom line. They're not interested in the health and welfare and safety of horses or the people involved in the sport. It's a very, very unforgiving sport. And
what do you mean unforgiving?
Well, horses are brought in. They're expected to race. They're given whatever drug within the limit they can be given to try and get out and win purse money. Jockeys' lives are at risk. Owners are paying a lot of money. Most owners are not hands-on, as I have been, so they don't know what really goes on the back stretches.
How much does it cost to feed a horse?
It varies depending on the stage of that horse's life and the activity. When a horse is at the racetrack at Belmont Aqueduct or Saratoga, it's approximately $4,000 a month is the upkeep on that horse, and that includes the, you know, the feed, the hay, the bedding, the daily care, blacksmith, and some veterinary work.
So, shorthand, how much does it cost to have a horse after you buy it?
A racehorse would be about $60,000 a year.
Yeah, yeah. And you had your own stables.
I did have my own stables.
But there are a lot of people who go out and rent space in stables, right?
Yes. Horses can cost anywhere from $300 a month if it's a riding horse or a pleasure horse in your backyard to the high end, being a racehorse at the track would be about $60,000 a year.
There's been great controversy at Central Park in New York City on Central Park South as to whether or not horses there are being abused. And obviously, the whole point of having you here is an analysis of abuse. Do you think those horses that were expected to pull people around in the park or outside the park were being abused?
Well, let me first say I personally love Manhattan. I lived in the city for 10 years. It's one of my favorite places on earth. I do not think Manhattan is a place for any animals, horses, dogs, or cats.
Interesting.
I have been through Central Park South. I have video that I've taken on 95, 96 degree days when horses are not supposed to be out in that weather. They are hot, miserable, uncomfortable, and there have been far too many accidents with carriage horses for it to be considered safe.
What do you mean accidents?
In New York, horses either breaking loose from their carriages or colliding with cars on the street. So in my opinion, no, it's not a place for horses or carriage rides. I understand the nostalgia, and I more than anyone love the old black and white movies of a horse and carriage through the park. But the reality is the city has changed a lot since then. The population has increased. The traffic is fast and furious. And to have a horse and carriage in the midst of that is, in my opinion, quite inappropriate.
Do you have dogs?
I do not, but I would love to get a dog.
The reason I ask that is you raised the dog question. There are many people, I think almost everybody in New York now has a dog, and you say you don't think dogs should be in New York. Andrew?
Well, you bring up the fact of dogs, and we've been talking about the equines and the horses. For every time that somebody has an animal, one of the biggest problems right now is the adoption of dogs. Dogs that people have gotten that they couldn't get along with. Right close to us, a woman runs a Jack Russell rescue. This woman has, I believe it's 45 Jack Russells that were all bought for people to have as a dog in their house, and they found out they just couldn't handle them. So the question is a balance of breeding the number of animals that actually can find a home. The same thing with horses. About 2,200 or 2,300 horses are slaughtered in this country every week. So at the same time that New York comes out with tax breaks and breeding incentives to breed thoroughbred racehorses, we're losing 60 to 70% of that population are going to slaughter.
Now, why would you slaughter a horse other than they're no longer useful to you, so you slaughter them? For a while, we were shipping them to France for people to eat. We don't do that anymore?
We still do.
Really?
We may not realize we still do, but 2,200 horses were slaughtered last week, and they went for people to eat.
I thought New York passed a law saying no more doing that.
Alan, what happens now is horses go to auctions in New York, and kill buyers are present at those auctions, and they ship the horses.
Kill buyers, definition.
Kill buyers are individuals that buy horses specifically to deliver them to slaughterhouses for butchering for horse meat.
And I believe the law that was passed was to remove federal inspectors from the slaughterhouses in the United States. So therefore, the horses aren't slaughtered here in the country, but they're shipped to Canada to be slaughtered.
They're shipped to Canada and Mexico.
Now, I take it, Andrew, you were drawing an analogy between the dogs and the horses before. You told us about, you know, overproduction of dogs and the fact that, you know, we have more than we need. Is that true of horses, too?
Yes, and it's subsidized. We have an overproduction of horses. We have more horses than we need. And the ones that aren't fit enough to race become dinner.
Mm. And what parts of the world are horses eaten in? We know about France.
France, Japan, China.
Wow. And
Cuba. A friend of mine is a farrier from Canada, and he went on his honeymoon to Cuba. And he got on the airplane, and they served him a steak. And he's eaten the steak, and it tasted different.
It was a Cuban airliner? Yeah. I doubt they're serving a horse on American Airlines, are they?
No. This was... Yeah. Well, it could have been. I don't know if American Airlines at that time flew into Cuba. But he gets on the plane, orders his dinner. His dinner comes. It's a steak. He's eating the steak and asks about it, and it's horse meat.
Wow. Wow. I had no idea. Because I remember Congressman John Sweeney was very instrumental in trying to stop the, you know, use of horses for slaughtering for meat. And I thought we had gotten somewhere.
We did, Alan. A bill passed to stop the inspection of public funding of inspections of horse slaughter plants in the United States. Mm-hmm. That resulted in the plants being closed down.
That's the way they thought they would get at it.
Right, a few years ago. And then currently a bill passed under Obama that allowed for slaughter plants to be reopened in the United States. And that's kind of in a little bit of a gray area right now. Several locations in the Midwest have proposed opening slaughter plants, and the communities have had such strong opposition to them that they have not opened.
So what's the difference between slaughtering a cow so we can eat a steak and slaughtering a horse so we can eat a steak?
Well, Alan, I don't know how graphic you want to get on the air, but it is a horrific death. Often the horses are still alive while they're being cut apart. It's nothing like a cow being stunned or an animal being shot in the head and instantly rendered dead and not feeling any pain.
Why couldn't you do the same thing?
I don't know why. That's a question I've asked. I'll take you through just a little bit of the process, which is so disturbing to me as a horse lover, and I think anyone who enjoys animals or has a heart for them. Most of the horses that are bred in the United States, aside from the Mustangs, are bred for a specific reason or a purpose. Some human wants those horses to come into the world, so they've mated them, they've raised them with loving care, with human contact. They were not bred for meat. They were bred for performance, for pleasure, for racing or showing. They're taken care of in, you know, the Waldorf Astoria, what that is to humans. There are stables like that to horses. They're fed, they're cared for, and they really have a very pleasant upbringing. And even at the racetrack, despite all of the drugging, the horses are taken care of as far as their, you know, their comfort, creature comforts. As soon as somebody decides they don't want a horse or a horse is no longer useful, they are shipped off to an auction. These are very dark, dank, seedy auctions, nothing like Fasig Tipton at Saratoga. They are the polar opposite. And that is where, unfortunately, horses meet up with kill buyers. At these same auctions, there is a large constituent of rescuers who are using Facebook and Twitter,
sure,
taking pictures saying this horse needs a bailout. So there is an uprising on the good side as well to try and save horses. But the horses, they get assigned to a kill buyer who buys them for as little as $10 or $50. I mean, horses that have sold for, you know, $100,000 to $300,000 at a racehorse auction are now being bought for $10, $25. They're loaded on a trailer, jammed into a trailer, and shipped thousands of miles to Mexico, you know, or north across the border to Canada, where they're held in kill pens. The way that a horse is killed, opposed to other livestock, is they're shuffled down a chute one by one, and in probably about a 8x8 space, so the horse can actually move around. Literally, what's called a captive bolt comes down and strikes the horse in the head, and that is always not an effective strike because the horse is moving about. And the horse is terrorized. They're in a panic. They're slipping. They smell blood. They know death. They have a lot of instincts. The horse is hit in the head, then brought on to the next part of the plant where they're literally hung upside down by their hind leg and cut apart. The problem is a lot of these horses are not dead when they're hanging upside down. And I say that as evidenced by USDA inspectors who have written reports to this effect repeatedly. And that was part of what went into having these plants closed in the first place.
Another difference that you might see is when you raise beef, cows, everything is documented. We know from our experiences with mad cow disease and other things in the food chain that the FDA is very closely monitoring. If you have a sick cow shows up at a meat packaging facility, they can trace that cow back to where it was born. You can't do that with horses. The antibiotics and other drugs that these cows are subject to is all documented because they can't be slaughtered within a certain time limit of having this. A horse can be on clenbuterol at a racetrack for 6 months, die of a heart attack induced by the clenbuterol, or become weak and incapacitated and end up in a slaughterhouse.
I wanted to ask you something, Andrew, if I could, following up on your job as a farrier, a horseshoer, and is this such thing as whistleblowing among people who work on horses? So in other words, if you're a farrier, you're brought in to do shoeing and you see something you don't like or that you think is unethical or immoral, does your profession acknowledge that sometimes you have a responsibility to say something about what you're seeing?
I don't believe there's any place for us to go. As evident by the report that Susan referred to that Governor Cuomo had done on the deaths of horses in Aqueduct, a professional jockey is riding a horse that he didn't feel warmed up well. The horse subsequently broke down in the race. When interviewed about it, the jockey pretty much said, "Yeah, I didn't think the horse was sound, but I did not want to say anything because I felt that my profession, my livelihood would be threatened because if I asked that horse be scratched, I would lose rides for that stable and maybe other stables."
Sure.
So in my profession, if you see something you're uncomfortable with, the only thing possible to do is to remove yourself from it. And people, there are a lot of good horse people out there. I've been lucky in my life to have worked for a lot of good horse people. People that take care of their help, people that take care of their animals. And the majority of people are that way. The question is, who dictates where that line is drawn? What's okay? Things that were okay 20 years ago are frowned upon now.
Susan, we have about 5 minutes more. This very interesting interview. I've learned all kinds of things here. I wonder if you could sort of bring it on home for us. In other words, what should be next? What do you want to see happen when the governor who has announced the reformation of NYRA for a while, and then apparently they're going to do something else with it, what do you want to see them do?
Well, I'd like to see them take proactive steps to clean up racing and to police the activity on the backstretch that results in horses dying and jockeys' lives being endangered.
What do you mean increased on the back stretch?
that they would oversee the drugs that veterinarians are dispensing, that a reporting, an accurate reporting system of drugs that horses are on is kept and maintained, that there would be a degree of transparency that an objective eye or board could look at and say, this isn't right. This is going to result in horses not only breaking down on the track, but then rendering these horses useless in second careers. I'd like to see an environment where jockeys could speak up, where veterinarians did not feel intimidated that they have to act at the behest of trainers or they will lose their job or some other veterinarian will get that account. It seems as though what has been incentivized is bad behavior. You know, if the highest purse money was for horses that didn't race on drugs, people would start training and stop using drugs. On the breeding end, I'd like to see New York State stop incentivizing breeding. There is no aftercare or retirement plan for the glut of horses that are going to come about as a result of the state incentivizing breeding.
Why are we doing that? In order to build up our racing industry? Is that the idea?
The idea is that horses are number two in agriculture in the state and that they contribute to the use of open and green spaces and that they are big job creators.
I mean, if you have a horse, you're going to have a farm to take care of the horse.
Exactly. And you're going to hire somebody to take care of that horse. So it's on the, you know, economic impact and job creation is how the horse industry is sold to the general public in New York. All commercial horse farms are exempt from sales tax. I don't know why they are. I would think that with all of the money available in New York to horse owners, that the state should start licensing the horses that are in New York, much like a dog license. It's a source of revenue that would be available to the state. It's certainly not going to stop horses from coming into the state, you know, if there's a fee to do that. And I'd like to see a coalition of like-minded people get together and not be afraid to speak up. And I wanted to go back to, you had referenced I did a 180. The reason I'm able to speak out is because I've divested myself from the industry. Had I chosen to speak up and share what I've shared and stayed in the industry, I believe it would be an impossibility at this point.
So do you ever turn around and say, God, I wish I had a horse?
I love horses. I help. I volunteer where I can. I help out every rescue. I've on my own Unbridled TV show.
Where can people see Unbridled?
Unbridled is on HRTV. It's in 20 million homes. Wow. It's on Dish 404, and it is on a number of cable providers throughout the country. And if one goes to hrtv.com, there's an input where you can simply put in your zip code and find out what carrier in your area.
There is HRTV. I know that in our area.
It's a tremendous network. It's much like what the Golf Channel is to golf. HRTV is,
well,
is to
what
horses.
Does HR stand for?
It stands for Horse Racing TV, and they originally started with a thrust just to cover horse racing, but now they've launched out into all horse activities, from, you know, fun videos of baby horses to somebody taking their first riding lessons to my show on Ireland.
Do people walk up to you and say, I know you from television?
It's funny. Over the years, yes, and most especially at Saratoga, because I had started Unbridled by interviewing all of the top trainers at Saratoga.
Are you poisoned now because you've been critical?
I probably am. but you know, I don't think that anybody can deny the fact that I have the best interest of horses at heart. I am bitterly disappointed that a lot of the people in the racing industry that I looked up to and I held in the highest esteem and even worked for some of them, that the actions that they have taken towards horses demonstrate that they don't really, really care about horses. And that's been the most disappointing.
Our guests have been Susan Cain, a licensed horse breeder and owner and the host of Unbridled on HRTV, and her husband, farrier Andrew Elsbury. Well, I didn't have the slightest idea what we're going to be getting into here, but I am so pleased that you spent all this time with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.